what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Why should you want to know?
About rent control. That's the buzz for two Seattle City Council members. Rents are up 8% over the last year. They say rent control is one way to make the city more affordable. It's the Week in Review here on KUOW. I'm David Hyde in for Bill Radke, and our panelists are here, too. They're chomping at the bit. The Mossback, Knute Berger, is here. You can read him at Crosscut and Seattle Magazine. Hi, Knute.
Hey, David.
Also with us, Rob McKenna, Republican former state attorney general, Rob McKenna. Hi, Rob.
Hey, David.
And Erica C. Barnett. She blogs now. You can read her at csforcrank.com. Hi, Erica.
Hello, David.
All right. So, Erica, I wanted to start with you. Last night, Kshama Sawant and Nick Licata making the case for rent control. What do you think?
Well, so the issue here is whether Seattle should be allowed to decide, right? And
because under state law, it's illegal for Seattle to actually pass rent control.
Correct. So, but the real question is whether we want rent control, whether we want to go the way of San Francisco and New York, the two cities that have most famously implemented rent control and have the most out of control rents in the country. And I know that it's from the hundreds of people who showed up last night to talk about this at Sawant's and Nick Licata's town hall. It's a very emotional issue. My rent personally has doubled over recent years, certainly not in the last couple of years, as some people were talking about. But it's an emotional issue, and it's appealing to want rent control for yourself. But the problem is it just protects people who have been here forever. If you moved in 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and you establish rent control, you're set. Anyone who's new is kind of out of luck.
This would be assuming that they design a rent control system so that new units would not be subject to rent control?
Well, I can't imagine that new units would be built if they were subject to rent control, because the financial disincentive to build new apartments would be so large. I mean, I think this discourages development, and ultimately what we need is more supply, not more control.
All right. Erica Barnett saying rent control, bad idea, because we do not want to punish Californians who come here to escape their drought. Rob McKenna, what do you think? Rent control.
I'm a supply sider too, Erica. It really does come down to increasing the supply of housing. There are a lot of reasons that the supply is not increasing fast enough. One of the reasons is the point you made, David, which a lot of people are moving up here to take jobs, and which grows our economy and is a net plus. But the system is very slow to allow more housing to be added, and especially in Seattle, where you have a great tradition of wonderful single-family neighborhoods. People are reticent, to say the least, about allowing a lot of multifamily housing to be constructed in a neighborhood that, historically has been single family. So, nevertheless, rent control is incumbent protection, and it doesn't solve the underlying problem of inadequate supply.
I was reading a little bit online, doing some research for this, and saw an old Paul Krugman article, liberal economist, New York Times economist Paul Krugman. Even Paul Krugman in that article citing 90% plus of economists saying that they were opposed to rent control. What's the economic case against it, Rob McKenna, from your point of view?
Well, any kind of price control accomplishes is to force the allocation of the resource to be driven by other factors. So, for example, if you have a shortage of bread and you put a price control on bread, you get really long bread lines. What you need to do is address the underlying shortage of bread. And so the other factor here is it's not ideological. It's really just practical, and it's based on a huge amount of experience. Many economies and societies have tried price controls for various goods, including housing, and again and again and again, they're proven not to work. So the definition of insanity being doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result, you don't want to try something that's proven to be failed experiment.
Knute Berger, what do you think?
Well, I actually like the idea of cities being able to decide whether to implement rent control or not. I certainly understand why it's implemented. It does have downsides, but I don't think it should be against state law. I think local municipalities ought to be able to decide. One of the problems with it is that landlords often want to then get the rent controlled tenants out of their buildings. And so and I had an aunt of mine experience this in New York. She lived on the Upper East Side for many decades, and they just stopped maintaining the building and just right. Let it fall into absolute decay in order to drive out people so that they could raise the rent. So there are a lot of kind of unintended consequences. But I think that the market solution is not going to work. I mean, the market wants to do some crazy things. I mean, a lot of the housing that's built is high-end housing. That's a reflection of a lot of inequalities in our economy. It also has to do with who houses are being sold to. I mean, one weird phenomenon, you see it a lot in Vancouver, and it's happened here to some degree, is a lot of people, there's kind of a false scarcity driven by people who are buying homes in Seattle and not living in them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see this in Belltown. You see it in Vancouver, where all those high rises, the people who own them don't live there.
It's not as false scarcity if you're trying to buy a house, though.
No, it isn't. And somebody was just telling me the other day about a friend of theirs that lives in a fairly affluent area of Seattle. And they were talking about the neighbors. And one neighbor was from the Far East and had bought the house as investment, and it's empty. Another neighbor, they had just bought a house, but they live in Sun Valley. These people, there's a scarcity being created by uber wealthy money pouring into the city. But I think that the whole rent control issue kind of comes down to, it's sort of a stand-in for these affordability questions, and supply is part of that equation.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other things we could
right.
do
yeah.
to work on it.
I talked to Dean Baker yesterday, and he addressed some of these concerns. He said actually on balance, he thinks it's not a terrible idea. It could be one tool in the civic toolbox. Yes, there's downsides, especially with developers deciding maybe they're not going to build new units if they can't charge market rents. But some of these other issues of decaying apartments can be addressed in other ways potentially. So it's all in the details and how it gets designed. But I wanted to get just to the politics of this. Why is this coming up right now, and what sort of a chance does it have? I was wondering, is this the next $15 an hour, or is it the next latte tax, which, failed back in 2003?
I don't think that it is going to catch on the way $15 an hour did. You're talking with $15 an hour about corporations. I mean, there's a real target that is sort of nebulous, like McDonald's. Nobody likes McDonald's. Nobody wants, fast food workers as this sort of general category of people to get, to not be able to live. With landlords, it's kind of different. I mean, you may know your landlord. You may, not want your landlord to, you may like your landlord. I mean, it's less of a target than fast food corporations. I don't think that it will necessarily go anywhere. I want to just address one thing Knut said mm-hmm. about the people who are coming in and buying investment properties. I think that is a problem, but the bigger problem is that people want to preserve their single family neighborhoods to such an extent that it's virtually impossible to do development in most of Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And the city is, talking about making that even more difficult with neighborhood conservation districts. And there's just a lot of pressure against development. And I do think that supply is not the only solution. We need government subsidies for affordable housing. We need to figure out how to pay for those. But supply is going to be a big part of the solution. A part of that is getting rid of the idea that every single family house is sacred.
You're right, David. Politically, this would be very hard to move through Olympia. The legislature will look at this and they'll see it as a Seattle problem. And if there's one thing that unites Democrats and Republicans across the state, it's they don't like Seattle. It's the usual small town, big town, divide. So this will be a hard sell for Seattle legislators to get through if they choose to even try it.
They're interesting. Crosscut had a story by Dick Nelson this morning, which talked about an idea where you would extend the state tax break on property tax the way we do for elderly people to renters, and that you would determine, particularly low-income renters, you would determine what percentage of their rent was property tax, and then give them some kind of a break on that. There's like a million things you can do in other areas to provide renters with relief, and I think it's a good campaign issue, even if people don't literally mean rent control. They want something done. I mean, nobody should be facing a $700 a month increase in rent.
Yeah, and it does seem like affordable housing, whether it's rent control or not, is definitely going to be a big issue here in Seattle in the upcoming elections for city council. You're listening to The Week in Review on KUOW. It's the Week in Review on KUOW. I'm David Hyde in for Bill Radke. Erica C. Barnett, Rob McKenna, and Knut Berger are also here. And this week, a famous actor made national news when he said this.
I want to build a pipeline, say, from Seattle, a place where there's a lot of water. There's too much water.
Mm-hmm.
How bad would it be to get a large 4-foot pipeline, keep it above ground, because if it leaks,
it's just water.
You're irrigating.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right.
If it leaks, the people pay you.
Right. Right.
And bring it down here and fill one of our lakes.
That's, of course, William Shatner. I can't even tell if he's being serious or just joking there, but there is a serious issue here. Hydrologists saying we're using ancient groundwater at an alarming rate. It's not just in California. It's happening all over the world, here in Washington, over in Saudi Arabia. But don't worry, California. We'll just take Seattle's water. It's the Week in Review on KUOW. And Knut Berger, Californians facing another water crisis, asking to take Washington state water. Were you surprised?
Well, no, actually. I was surprised that it came from the mouth of William Shatner, who's not somebody you turn to when you think about how to deal with climate change or whatever. But he's voicing an idea that's been around for over 50 years, which is Californians in particular have wanted to get their hands on Columbia River water. They see water roll on Columbia, you know, as being a waste. You know, it's wasted. It's going into the ocean. They're not using it. There was a guy who was on the board of supervisors down there for like 40 years that was after Columbia River water. Scoop Jackson swooped in and made it virtually impossible for California to get our water. He basically said before the federal government would ever study such a thing, the governors of Washington and Oregon would have to sign off on that study. The water in the Columbia River is not wasted. As those of us here know, I mean, it produces hydroelectric power. It's vital to shipping. It's vital to wildlife, the ecosystems, salmon restoration. So, you know, William Shatner looks at that and sort of thinks that ought to be in my swimming pool. Mm. And I think part of the response a lot of people here have is look at Palm Springs. How many swimming pools and golf courses are being watered in the desert where, frankly, no human ought to be able to sustain life. I mean, it's as life-sustaining as Antarctica.
But groundwater is also being drilled here in Washington State. We've also got a drought this year. And, you know, I was wondering how much of this is sort of about our belief as a society that ultimately we can turn to sort of either the final frontier, other planets, or Washington State to bail us out. You know, there's an endless supply of materials and resources and commodities, and someone's going to help us. Someone's going to save us. We don't have to conserve. Rob McKenna, what do you think?
Well, piling on Skip's point about swimming pools and golf courses, there's also agriculture. I mean, we would effectively be subsidizing water-intensive agriculture in California.
Mm-hmm.
So the image that Captain Kirk would have us think of as thirsty residents of California, but it's really thirsty farm fields that would be the main beneficiary here. What they need to do is move to less water-intensive products. You know, one thing they do grow that's less water intensive is grapes. But down in the Central Valley, they're growing a lot of other products like lettuce that are very water intensive.
Almonds, rice.
Almonds are apparently one of the most water intensive crops you can grow. I think they ran into that in Texas, and was it West Texas? They've had to cut down a lot of the trees because they simply didn't have the water for them.
They're so tasty, though. Erica Barnett, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't think this is a. Here's where I go away from the supply side. Argument. You know, we are demanding these things. I mean, what if we suddenly didn't have rice, or the price of rice skyrocketed because California stopped producing it? I mean, yes, it is incredibly water intensive. So are almonds. But the demand for California to be farmland comes from all of us. It doesn't. And the drought doesn't come, you know, primarily from, you know, swimming pools in Palm Springs. It comes from the rest of the country wanting California to be this, you know, this breadbasket or this rice basket. And
the rest of the world, actually.
The rest of the world, sure. And to get to your original question, I think William Shatner is being facetious, and I think this is kind of performance art. But, you know, the idea of an above ground four-foot pipeline is just
you know,
visually
if the
hilarious.
Pipe were open, you could sell kayak rides in it. It could be actually.
That would
I hadn't
be
thought
sweet.
Of that. Yeah, maybe it'd pay for itself.
If it's performance art, it's the same quality as Shatner's version of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Never heard that.
Kinnit, I want to get to this this kind of somewhat serious question about where this is all headed, where we're headed as a society. There's proposals for nuclear powered desalinization plants, and then there's proposals to conserve water. To take Navy showers and to not, necessarily grow almonds in the desert. Where do you think this is headed?
Well, one of the things I think it's headed is that climate change is causing people to reflect on the fact that resources like water, which we once took for granted as being incredibly plentiful, are in fact not. The Canadian government just came out with a study showing that by 2100, the year 2100, 70% of British Columbia and Alberta's glaciers will have melted. I mean, and a lot of Columbia River water, by the way, comes from those sources. Mm-hmm. It's a huge problem, and there has to be some kind of response. And there is. Water managers in Seattle that have done, I think, a pretty amazing job. Seattleites are conserving water at an incredible rate. We're using now, with more than double the population, less water than we were using in the 1950s. So you have to do conservation, but you also have to find new ways of managing the water in the form that it comes. We're going to get less water in terms of snow. We're probably going to get the same amount of more water in terms of rain. So how do you handle that with reservoirs? How do you handle the irrigation system if they don't have snowpack to count on and that kind of thing? So there's a lot of figuring out that has to go on. Shatner's right. It's going to take a big investment in infrastructure to make that happen. And I think you're going to find more intense competition around water.
I think conservation is absolutely the key. And I think Skip is right that it's going to require capital investment. But I think a lot of the capital investment needs to be made in places people don't normally think of. For example, there's a tremendous amount of leakage just in the connection between the water main and the street in front of your house and your house. If you live in a house that's very old, there's a tremendous amount of water that leaks, and this is a problem because of who owns that water pipe. The homeowner owns it instead of the water supplier, and so no one's taking care of those pipes. But it creates enormous amounts of waste. I think we're going to start thinking a lot more about those kinds of investments and those kinds of maintenance issues as water becomes more and more precious.
Are you for or against long hot showers?
How can you be against a long hot shower? That would be wrong.
All right, Rob McKenna gets the last word. You're listening to The Week in Review here on KUOW. It's the Week in Review on KUOW, and State Treasurer Jim McIntyre's out with a new proposal that would shake things up. He says it's time for a 5% income tax, but he says it's not like the proposed income tax on high earners that failed back in 2010.
Well, this is very different than the last proposal that was on the ballot. The last proposal was an ideological proposal that said, let's go poke the rich folks in the eye. Let's tax the rich. It was about raising new revenue with a new tax without really any offset to it.
So under this proposal, the state property tax would go away, the sales tax would go down, and it would also lower taxes on businesses. Rob McKenna, I want to start with you. Seattle has the most regressive tax system in the United States. I was reading, if you're willing to accept the pejorative word regressive, poor residents pay around 17% of their total family income every year in state and local taxes. 17%. If you're in the top 1%, it's a lot of percentages, you pay between 2-3%. So it's a pretty big gap there. What do you think needs to be done to deal with that, if it's the income tax or something else?
Well, it's almost an academic question because the voters have been extremely clear and noisy about the fact they don't want an income tax. It's often pointed out that Oregon has the opposite problem. They've been trying to institute a sales tax and reduce their income tax, and the voters are very noisily opposed to that as well. So I agree with your initial point, which is this is just not very likely to happen at all. The voters turned down the last proposal by a huge margin, and notwithstanding Treasurer McIntyre's efforts to differentiate his idea, the voters aren't going to see it differently. They're not going to boil it down to those details. They're going to look at it and they're going to say no. So there'll have to be other steps that are taken to address tax fairness, and that one's just not going to be on the table as a tool that McIntyre or anyone is going to have.
But what do we do? You know, that difference between 17% and 2-3%, is that a problem? And if so, what do we do about it?
Well, I think for one thing, you have to be really careful when policymakers toss out ideas for sales tax increases or other increases that are regressive because they're not tied at all to your income earning potential. We have other taxes that are less regressive, like the property tax, and you're going to see a greater reliance on the state property tax to fund basic education in schools. So, in fact, substituting the state property tax for local property taxes to fund our schools would make the system less regressive, because right now Seattle property taxpayers and Mercer Island and Bellevue are effectively being subsidized by property taxpayers in Pasco and in other communities that are poor and have to have higher local levy rates to offset lower assessed valuation. So that's something that we could do that would fund our schools and make that part of our tax system less regressive.
Knut Berger, there's still talk of Seattle passing some sort of income tax. It's not legal, but the whole idea is to challenge state law. You've been an advocate, I think, for that. What do you think?
Well, I'm an advocate for Seattle to have the right to decide.
Mm-hmm.
And again, just like with rent control, I think local jurisdictions like Seattle ought to be able to create an income tax for citizens if they want. There are lots of cities that have income taxes. And you can argue about whether it's good or bad, but I think we ought to have the right to make up our own minds about it. And I'm in favor of state income tax, but the term income tax is still toxic politically. It's one of those things that's going to take kind of a long slog of working at it to make it palatable, if it will ever be considered palatable. I noticed, for example, that Republican advertisements on the radio against the governor's proposal for or was it the House proposal for a capital gains tax on the wealthy? They call it the capital gains income tax.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason they use that phrase.
Why is that? And you know, I'm not originally from Washington State. You are. Why is it so toxic here?
Well, I mean, the last time Washingtonians voted on the idea of an income tax and passed it was in the 1930s. It was during the Depression and the New Deal era. And then it was knocked down by the Supreme Court. They said it was unconstitutional. Income tax was essentially a taking, as I understand it. Was it not?
It was struck down because the Constitution requires that all property be taxed uniformly, which prevents you from having a progressive income tax, given that income is a form of property.
Right. So it got knocked down. It's never been able to get back on its feet. And I think the biggest fear people have is the slippery slope argument, which is, it's the one thing tax we don't have. If you put that in, they might say it's for the wealthy today, but tomorrow it's going to be, you know, it's going to slide down, and eventually we'll all be paying it, and we'll pay the sales tax. Have you ever seen a tax go away? So unless you have some sort of comprehensive package that promises this is going to go away, this is going to come in, this is, you know, and demonstrate that to people, but it's very hard to make that politically that process politically viable, because people in the two parties are resistant to even discussing certain ideas, even if privately they know it's not a bad one.
Well, Erica, State Treasurer Jim McIntyre says now's the time to start talking about a state income tax. What do you think?
I think that I agree with Knut that a state income tax is toxic. I think that a capital gains tax, if the Democrats can pitch it more as what it actually is, a tax on capital gains, not a tax on income, and pitch the fact that it's narrowly targeted and that most people don't have capital gains. We all do have income. I think that's a possibility. I think at the city level, you know, I would certainly be in favor of allowing us to have that conversation. I think the risk at the city level is we have incredibly high sales taxes already that are very regressive on the poor. And the question would be, is that going to go away? Will that be substituted with a more fair system like an income tax, or would it just be in addition to our incredibly high sales taxes?
All right. Well, since you insist on talking about what might actually happen, we've actually got Austin Jenkins on the line. He's our Olympia correspondent. Hi, Austin.
Good morning.
Hey, so what are just from you, what are the chances we're going to see a state income tax in 2015 or even 2016? What do you think?
I give it the big, I think the governor talked about a goose egg this week. I think we can give it the big goose egg, the big nil.
All right, ain't going to happen. What about a capital gains tax? What taxes will we potentially see in 2015 to deal with the McCleary decision on education, the state Supreme Court decision on education, potentially big transportation package and other issues that the state faces this year?
Yeah, so on the transportation side, you know, an increase in the gas tax seems likely. Plausible. It may be the last time a gas tax package is funded largely with a gas tax, but that seems to be the vehicle du jour right now for funding these things. On the operating budget side, you know, new taxes are a tough sell. So the capital gains tax is a new tax. I think taxes will be a part of the final analysis here, just sort of that logically you can conclude that because you've got Democrats pushing for them, Republicans opposing them, and somewhere in the middle you get some taxes. But probably what they'll end up doing is closing some exemptions. Maybe they'll do the B&O tax surcharge. And they won't do $1.5 billion. They may not even do half of that, which is $750 million. It may be more like $400 to $500 million. But again, rearranging the tax structure, adding new taxes and income tax, those kinds of things are part of a conversation perhaps, but I don't see them as part of the actual end game.
Why isn't it a part of horse trading that might happen down there? Why wouldn't it be a situation where Democrats could give something up in exchange for a capital gains tax? It's just, you're just saying it's a non-issue.
Is there something Republicans want badly enough that they would vote for a capital gains tax?
That's my question.
I haven't seen it yet.
That would be no.
The answer is no on that one. Okay. And remind us where we are, Austin, in the session and kind of where things are headed.
We're at the end where the sales are luffing. Not much is happening.
The end and the beginning.
And right. And we're about to, you know, act two, the special session. So the governor has called a special session for next Wednesday. It's actually early. Usually the governor waits until the regular session actually ends to call the special session. He didn't even bother. The writing's on the wall. It's going to be needed. He's called him back on Wednesday. He wants the budget writers in his office on Monday. And I think really this is like hitting the reset button. He had them in a couple of weeks ago and said taxes have to be part of the solution. I think that riled the Republicans a little bit. Now his tone is they still have to be part of the solution, but everybody's got to compromise. So he's trying out some new language. Hit the reset button, get everybody in. And he says it can be done in 30 days. In 2013, it took until, June 29th?
Right,
so
that's
I'm
right.
Already hearing bets for that date.
All right. So a truly special session, probably not, but a regular old special session is likely.
A regular old special session is definite.
Austin, I also want to ask you about one other item in the news. Senator Baumgartner over in Spokane wants to punish left-lane drivers, people who camp in the left lane, basically. What's the proposal?
He's driving over from Spokane and driving back. He's got kids that he'd like to see. I think he's already, in the spokesman review, expressed some frustration at that commute. I expect where he's finding the most frustration is when he gets off of Highway 18, hits I-5, and, you know, is trying to get to Olympia. I've experienced that myself. But basically, he's saying it's already illegal to drive in the left lane, you know, and hold up traffic. As I understand it, that's not widely enforced by the state patrol. But he basically wants a tiered or graduated fine. So the slower you're going in the left lane, the higher the fine. and he thinks that would be, you know, dissuade people from hogging the left lane. Now, maybe the problem is out on I-90. He also wanted to boost the speed limit out there. He'd like to, I think, make it a more efficient commute between Spokane and Olympia.
All right. Thanks, Austin.
You're welcome.
All right, panelists, I want to put that question to you about left lane camping. Knute Berger, what do you think about Senator Baumgartner's proposal?
Well, you know, I'm just not sure. It's not on my top 10 list of problems with driving. I mean, I can see why it's annoyance. I understand what the law is. I generally abide by it. Although I was brought up to think that if you were going the speed limit, you could drive in any lane. That was the philosophy I grew up with. So I can see why it drives people crazy. I do like his idea of raising the speed limit on I-90. I pity anybody who has to commute regularly from Spokane. I had to I spent about a year going to Spokane once, twice, even more a month back and forth by car. It's just a long, tedious, boring drive on a very straight, large highway. And yeah, let people go fast. I'm for that.
Rob McKenna, what do you think?
I was just listening to the guy from Ballard telling us how we should drive. I got distracted. I was also envisioning a conversation between an insurance agent and the driver. Insurance agent, why did you get this ticket? Driver, I was driving too slow. That would raise some interesting questions. I think the key problem that my friends in the State Patrol would point out is one of enforcement. They're already having enough trouble enforcing the laws against distracted driving. The ultimate solution to this will probably be driverless cars, actually. And those are coming, and they'll be very common in 20 years. And they'll solve that problem for us because they'll always follow the law. But enforcing a rule against left-lane camping would be pretty hard, particularly in urban areas. It would be easier in the more rural areas, but it's less of a problem there.
I wonder if more people are driving slow in the left lane now that pot's legal. Erica, what do you think?
About that? No. I have no opinion. I don't think that you should become a state legislator from Spokane if you don't want to make the drive. I don't think that raising the speed limit, first of all, will substantially decrease that commute time. But in any case, the idea of slowing people down or speeding people up in the left lane is, as Michael Baumgartner has proposed it, is completely preposterous because you'd have to go exactly the speed limit to avoid being out of line with the law. And driverless cars, here's why. Good I think point. that you're wrong, Rob, about yeah. that. People like to drive faster than the legal limit, and I don't think people are going to embrace driverless cars that follow the law.
The reason they'll embrace driverless cars is that they'll have lots of other things to do with their time besides pay attention to driving. They will be drawn to their screens, and they'll let the car do the driving for them, and time will fly by for them.
That's a great argument for public transit.
Well, now you can see, now you can see why that group of Spokane area legislators proposed a commission to divide Washington into two states. You see, then they could get a capital that was close to home. They lost out. They couldn't get the capital in Pomeroy. They couldn't get it in Ellensburg. People fought over where the state capital was going to be, and they're probably still bitter about that.
All right. You're listening to The Week in Review on KUOW. I'm David Hyde, in for Bill Radke with Knute Berger, Erica Barnett, and Rob McKenna. We'll be back in just a minute. It's The Week in Review on KUOW. Everyone's talking about street crime in downtown Seattle. Yesterday, Mayor Ed Murray announced around 100 arrests, part of a new effort to go after crime in the downtown retail core. They want to zero in on blocks where there's a lot of crime, and they're branding this the 9.5 block strategy. Knute Berger, what do you think?
Well, there is a crime problem down there, and they're responding to it. There are parts of it that sound good to me, which is trying to get more access to various kind of social and mental health services, having more police presence that's more continuing. I mean, at one time, I remember during, I think, of the Nichols years, the main police presence in that area were those military nutcrackers down there. I mean, it's an area where there's a chronic problem. But when I say chronic problem, I mean a problem that's been there in one form or another for 100 years. The Pike Street corridor has mm-hmm. been sketchy for a very long time. And what's happened is vice crackdowns usually simply move the problem from one area to the other. So whether it'll actually solve anything or whether it'll push people back into Belltown, the area that used to be right where kind of the Pike Place Market in Belltown meet by the viaduct there used to be called the Blade.
Mm-hmm.
That was the big drug dealing area for a long time.
Still called the Blade, according to the article.
Is it still called?
That's what it said in the
All right. So you can crack down in one area. It's a kind of ground zero, both because a lot of tourists go there, a lot of convention business, major retailers are there. The real question is, where's it going to go? What's your strategy? Because it's not going to go away overnight.
Rob McKenna, what do you think about this idea of a targeted approach to go after an area that's, it's been high crime for a long time? What do you think?
Yeah, I think that they have to try it. The over-concentration of this problem down there is noticeable. The statistics bear it out, or you can just walk down there and experience it for yourself. It's the opposite of the broken window. The approach where you fix the broken window and stop the problem from getting worse. Here you've got a severe problem, so you go down and you tackle it. And absolutely, you have to address the substance abuse and drug addiction factors here and the mental illness, because that all factors in as well. So they really have to get in there, because if you don't address it effectively, the problem doesn't stay the same. It gets worse and gets progressively worse. So kudos to the mayor for trying this, and I hope it works, but it will require a complex of services, not just law enforcement. The cops would be the first one to tell you that they can't solve this problem by themselves. Having walked that area with Seattle police and with community corrections officers when they were allowed to team up, it is a big problem that they alone can't solve.
So, Rob McKenna, step in the right direction. Erica Barnett, you walk that area without Seattle police as a transit rider. What's it like these days?
That bus stop, and that is one of my frequent bus stops. It's crowded. It's messy. There's lots of dealers. There's lots of people buying and selling drugs and stuff, stuff that they've shoplifted. And despite all that, I personally don't feel unsafe there. I feel more sad, because I think that a lot of those people, if not the majority, are addicts themselves and do need help. I don't know that the approach that the mayor is taking by saying, we're going to arrest you, but you can do this diversion program called LEAD, is the most effective way of providing social services to people. I think that, you could probably go down there and find that the majority of those people who are down there could benefit from some form of services without necessarily being arrested for low-level crimes. Because as people were pointing out to me on Twitter last night, when you arrest a dealer, and they arrested 95 dealers and contacted, they claim, 186 dealers, you're really arresting a user. And so from the perspective of cleaning the place up for tourists or whatever, it may be effective, but from the perspective of actually solving the root causes of the problem, I don't know that it will be.
So you and Canute kind of agree that you might be pushing it into other parts of the city?
Oh, definitely.
But when you do that, I'm sorry, Erica.
I was just going to say, definitely, it's not going to go away just because you close a bus stop.
I think that's true, but there is a fair amount of evidence that that scattering it actually reduces the negative effects from the problem. The concentration actually creates more intense problems than if it's spread out.
That's interesting. Why is that?
It's probably sort of normal human behavior, where you have a concentrated amount of bad behavior. People are taking their cues from each other, and so it keeps raising the level of bad behavior because there's so much of it going on around them, and it seems to be socially acceptable. So spreading it out, just like it's analogous to not concentrating all your low-income housing in one neighborhood. It's much better for the people who live in low-income housing if that housing is spread throughout the city and people live next door to middle-class people and other people.
Yeah, it's also like in retail tends to do better in clusters, and that's works for the drug business just like anything else. Bookstores like to be in the same neighborhood often. They like to be near libraries. Why? Readers are there.
Another question I had about this, Gene Bock in the Seattle Times looked at the crime stats, and only 7% of crime is actually happening in the downtown retail core. There's a lot more in Beacon Hill, for example. So is this the right place? Is this where we ought to be concentrating our efforts?
Well, defining crime based on arrests, the problem is under enforcement in this area. That's what we're getting at here.
Is it? What do you think?
Well, there is there is crime and drug dealing in other parts of the city, parts of Beacon Hill, for example. But downtown is the golden goose. Downtown is the place where you have powerful retailers, you have powerful the chamber, the downtown association, very powerful constituency groups. They want the face of Seattle to be more positive for people that are going from the convention center and the hotels down to the Pike Place Market and whatnot. So there's definitely it gets attention because of that.
So what about for you, Knut? On balance, is this plan a step in the right direction or is it not?
Oh, I guess it's a step in the right direction. I mean, one of the things I don't like about it, I don't like them closing alleys. I don't like them removing seating from down there. There are ways in which they punish the rest of us, or they take public space out in a way that I generally don't like. But in terms of having more police presence down there, I think that's totally appropriate.
Erica, what do you think?
I love the idea of having more police presence down there, particularly police on foot or on bikes. I think that is a great solution. I don't think just arresting everybody is going to solve the problem. And the problem with moving a bus stop a block away is that affects all transit riders. And that's a lot more people than the number of drug dealers that are clustered at Third and Pine.
So this is a step in the wrong direction?
It's a step sort of to the side, a sideways step.
And Rob McKenna?
Yeah, I think they have to try this. But again, I agree with Erica. You can't just arrest people to solve the problem. You have to get at the root causes as well. Nevertheless, the deterrent effect of having more uniformed officers will be felt. It'll help by dispersing or diluting the problem. But I have to say, David, one other thing, one like 20-second rant about how badly we treat the mentally ill in this country. You know, we went away from institutionalization. Now we don't have nearly enough facilities. The jails are the biggest mental health facilities in the state. And every time I see a severely mentally ill person in Seattle or when I'm in San Francisco, I see this a lot. I just think, how is this humane? This person is going to die. You know, and are we patting ourselves on the back as a society? Well, we're not putting them in a mental health facility. We're giving them their liberty. But it's not humane at all for someone that sick to be left to wander around the streets to hurt themselves, perhaps others. That is something we've got to get our arms around in this state.
All right. So the panel's in agreement. Policing, okay, but it's not enough. You're listening to The Week in Review here on KUOW. You're listening to The Week in Review here on KUOW. Ivers did it. Now Seattle restaurateur Renee Erickson says she's going to abolish tipping at her restaurants like The Walrus and The Carpenter. The plan is to include a service fee of 18.5% and not accept tips. So how close are we to a tipping point when it comes to tipping here in Seattle? Is this a cultural turning point where we could see a future of less tipping? Knut Berger, what do you think?
Well, it is a tipping point of a kind. And one of the things I'm interested in is the sort of tipping culture. I mean, some people have criticized tipping because of the inequity it causes within the workforce at a restaurant. But there are also cultural elements, too, where servers here have to be servile. They have to, you know, go overboard when they're trying to keep guests happy in order to get a tip, in order to have their income at a reasonable level. Whereas in Europe, you pay a service fee, and you know, the people who are serving you could be elderly. They're people who've spent their life in doing that kind of job, and culturally they're more respected, I think. And so I think it's interesting going to this new system is not only kind of an economic shift, but it's suggesting a cultural shift that I'm not sure America is quite ready for, but it'll be interesting.
And Rob McKenna, I want to stick with this cultural theme, but of course Renee Erickson and Ivers both saying that they're doing this partly in response to the fact that Seattle's bumped up the minimum wage to $15, and this is a way of kind of dealing with that.
But how do they think it deals with that? I don't understand the connection.
Between having a service fee?
Yeah, well, I mean, so the minimum wage has gone up,
right?
And they're going to add 18.5% on top of your bill automatically, regardless of service quality or what have you. So their thinking is it helps them with the minimum wage by doing it, by making it less expensive to eat out. out because you don't feel like you need to do
it. It has to do with the fact that they wanted to have a tip credit as a part of the some people
that
don't
I understand
it as a part of the existing minimum wage, and this is one way of dealing with that. Renee Erickson also said actually it's a way of equalizing between the front of the house and the back of the house. That was another
That strikes me as a good justification to eliminate tipping.
Yeah, but other restaurants are saying the same thing, that they may eliminate tipping. So the question really is, what would it be like to live in a more European-esque society where tipping has gone the way of the dodo bird?
They haven't really eliminated it then. I mean, if you stick it in as an 18.5% service fee, you're
well, we've eliminated the kind of culture of tipping, right? Because it's a required fee.
Well, here's the economic conservative argument for it. It's that incentives work, and that at the margin you'll get better service if the server is more motivated to get a bigger tip. It also benefits servers in a different way, although I suppose the 18.5% might as well, which is it motivates them to upsell you, to get you to buy more stuff, because the bigger the total bill, the bigger the tip, since it's based on the total sale.
Is the service worse in France or places where tips or service is included? I don't really know.
Well, I mean, my experience of service in Europe is that it's more efficient, less friendly.
Less interactive. They don't talk
exactly
to you as much.
It isn't that kind of, almost slavish attention to the customer's every whim. It's more like, here we're doing what we're doing.
I just wanted to point out that what Ivars did and what Renee Erickson is doing are very different things.
Yes.
Ivars is basically saying, I'm going to institute a tip credit myself by saying everyone will make $11 an hour this year and they will not get any tips. Renee Erickson is imposing this service.
So they're raising their minimum wage to 15 now.
Oh, is that?
Ivers. Okay. Ivers is going up to 15.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So they're saying we're going to institute this tip credit completely right now. And I think in that case, the people, will actually make significantly less money as servers or, workers at Ivers, as opposed to Renee Erickson's restaurants where, it probably comes out in the wash.
Mm. Is Renee going to direct the 18.5% to her staff then? Is that dedicated to them?
And sort of more equitably from the front in the back of the house, as I understand it, which means if you were a server there, I guess you'd be making less in tips, right?
My sense was that they were going to, the people at the front of the house were going to get pay equivalent to what they're getting now, basically, and then the back of the house people would get more. So everybody would kind of come up.
Kashamba Sawant says the service industry is demeaning. It's a demeaning profession, and that she thinks getting rid of tipping and the culture of tipping is actually a good thing. Erica, what do you think of that?
This is a tough one for me because I worked in the service industry for many years. I was in retail, not in food service. And so that's not a tipped type of job. But I don't think that they are demeaning jobs. I think that they're actually perfectly good, honorable jobs, and that, regardless of whether they're tipped or not. I don't agree with that most servers I've seen here in Seattle are servile. I do agree that it might take away some of that incentive to be extra nice or extra sort of obsequious, but and I haven't been to Europe a whole lot, so I don't have experience in that area, but I don't think that they are demeaning jobs inherently at all.
All right. I'm hearing a fair amount of agreement then on whether or not we ought to do away with tipping. You're listening to The Week in Review here on KUOW. This week, Washington State Parks announced that they're going to do something new for campers. This is at Moran State Park up on Orcas Island. It's called glamping, glamorous camping. You arrive at your campsite. There's a queen bed, fresh linens. If you pay extra, they're actually going to deliver coffee to your tent door at 8 o'clock in the morning. So the question is this the right move for state parks to deal with some of the funding cuts or issues that they've been facing? Or is this the decline of Western American civilization? Rob McKenna, Eagle Scout, are you a glamper or a camper?
Hey, the older I get, the more I glamp than camp, as long as I don't glamp in the left lane. But I tell you what, you know, I think this is a good thing. The parks, the poor parks, you know, the state budget's been zeroed out for them. They have to make it entirely on their own now. Good for them to innovate and find ways to attract more people to our beautiful parks, to use them. If they need a little more comfort, why not? And if it allows them to generate revenue that people are happily paying, why not? We faced this with Marymore Park, and I was on the county council. We had to get creative in how to make a go of it over there, and we put in dollar a day parking, and we put in some concessionaires and some other improvements that have worked really well. Now they have concerts there and so forth.
So
all
you have no
we had to raise more money.
You have no anxiety about the loss of self-reliant Washingtonianism.
Are you saying people will become softer and weaker?
I don't know. I was wondering if you might.
Species might be diminished. You know, not everyone wants to go out and sleep on the hard ground anymore. So why not give people a variety of options?
Knut Berger, are you a glamper or a camper?
I'm a glamper. I'm in Rob's camp on this one. I think that, he's absolutely right. What they've done to state parks is an absolute disgrace. And in more ways than one, but they have to creatively find ways to raise more revenue. They're renting out things like lighthouses and whatnot for that people can stay in. I think that's a great idea. I think the idea of having some of these tents with beds. I've stayed in places like this. There was a great place in Santa Barbara I stayed in where you very much like this. It was tents along a river. With very comfortable beds and mosquito netting and all kinds of stuff. It was sort of like being on safari. It was really nice. Oregon is famous for its yurt mm-hmm. system. They have yurts all over.
Erica Barnett, do you camp? Would you glamp?
I camp. And I love camping. I love sleeping on the hard ground. I don't think it's a morally superior position.
All right.
I would glamp.
All right. The correct answer then, glamping. Our guest this week, Knut Berger, the Moss Back. You can read him at crosscut.com. He's also a columnist at Seattle Magazine. Thanks, Knut.
Thank you.
Erica C. Barnett, longtime Seattle journalist, transit wonk, blogger at C. The C is for crank.com. Thanks, Erica.
Thank you.
And Rob McKenna, Republican former state attorney general. Thank you so much for being here.
You bet.
You can stay with touch with us on Facebook. We're at KUOW Public Radio. KUOW's Week in Review is produced by Jason Pagano. I'm David Hyde. Bill Radke will be back in this seat next week at the same time. Thanks for listening.